Hello, Claremont. Welcome to another episode of Claremont Speaks. I'm Russ Binder, your host, and we have another absolutely outstanding guest, someone I am just thrilled to have. Our guest this week was born and raised in Claremont, graduated from the Webb Schools and Occidental College. He's worked for Democratic campaigns over the last four election cycles, starting with Congressman Howard Berman's 2012 campaign. He's currently working for the Fallen Journalists Memorial Foundation to pass congressional legislation to raise funding for a memorial to those fallen in service, and he is running for City Council in District 1. Please welcome Ethan Resnick, City Council candidate. How are you, Ethan?
I'm good. Good to be with you, Russ. Thanks for doing this. I'm such a huge fan of your show. Every interview you do is just absolutely fantastic. So I'm just so happy to be here with you.
That is the kind of praise that will get you much favor in the future. Thank you very much for the kind words. I've had a lot of positive reactions to this. Even a woman in San Dimas who's doing a similar show called me up and said, oh, I love it because you're doing exactly what I'm doing for Claremont. And she's been at it a little longer, but yeah, she likes it too. So thank you, thank you, thank you.
Yeah,
let's start. Even though you've been in Claremont all your life, pretty much, maybe not everybody knows you as well as some. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to running for the city council.
Yeah, so as you said, born and raised in Claremont, even when I was at Occidental College, and I've always loved this community. And I lived here for, I think, most of the time I was at Oxy. And because I just wanted this community to remain a part of my life on a regular basis. And so I decided to stick around. As you pointed out, I've worked on many campaigns. And I did that because at a certain point, I was always a big fan of The West Wing growing up. My father would always be watching it, and I would be there watching it with him, not knowing anything that was going on. But once I started learning about it, I decided that just watching the show wasn't good enough anymore. And I wanted to actually get involved with, you know, local politics. And so at the ripe old age of 14, I decided to just volunteer on, you know, Congressman Howard Berman's campaign, just doing whatever needed to be done in the office, going door to door, helping out staffers. It's just such a fun environment. And I never thought politics could be just so fun and kind of a team sport the way it is.
So I think it's really cool that at that age, you wanted to not just see the show, you wanted to be the show.
I wanted to be the show. I wanted to live the show.
For me, I would have been at that age, it would have been like, oh, I'm going to be Batman. That's cool. But I lacked the billions of Bruce Wayne and all the cool toys.
Yeah. And as I got older, just year after year, elections aren't only on even years. You have municipal elections on odd years sometimes. And so year in and year out, I'd be reaching out to candidates and people I knew just saying, hey, could I help out whenever I'm free? And they're like, yeah, come on by. And I would always make really good friends with all of the campaign staff and even the candidates. And it was just such a great experience. And that's really what warmed me up to be running for, you know, the city council of my hometown at the age of 22, as we'll discuss. I've been very involved with my synagogue here in town at Temple Beth Israel, and I've been able to keep this core group of friends. And we've always been so engaged on issues of importance, on issues of, you know, social justice. And I even traveled with, you know, my rabbi when I was in high school to Washington, D.C., me and some of my friends, to go lobby our members of Congress on issues of importance, like gun violence prevention and many other issues that we discussed. And so those are the types of things that I've loved being involved in my whole life. I come from a conservative Jewish family. And when I say conservative, I don't mean politically conservative, religiously conservative, the three different sects of Judaism. And we take that to heart because we like to practice, you know, what we call Judaism in action. We don't just espouse the beliefs of the ideals of our faith, but we also try to live those philosophies in real life, which is why my aunt decided to leave law to start a nonprofit foundation to help prevent genocide in many African nations and to give to those who are suffering.
And from your website, I understand that your family has a history with that that would make the prevention of such kind of near and dear to their hearts.
Correct. Yeah. It's very reasonable. It makes complete sense why we've decided to practice our faith this way, because my grandparents are Holocaust survivors. My grandfather sadly passed away 2 years ago at the age of 90, but my grandmother is still alive today. Her memory is perfectly intact. And once I got old enough, she started, you know, telling me, and, you know, all the other grandkids too, we started to learn the stories of what happened. And she's from Poland. My grandfather was from what was then Ukraine. And so they fled the Nazis and they luckily got away. Our other family members, their siblings and cousins, were not so lucky, but they got away, which is why I'm here today. And they eventually moved into the Soviet Union because they were really the only country that would let them in. Even the US wasn't letting in many people. And so eventually they met in a displaced persons camp at what used to be Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. And that's where they actually met. And then soon thereafter, finally, they moved to Israel where they got married and then lived there for 10 years, had my dad and had my uncle there. And then they moved to the U.S. in 1961. And so I'm actually the first Resnick generation born in the United States.
Well, congratulations and welcome, of course. But I think that's an awesome story. My great-grandfather left Germany prior to World War I when the Kaiser and all that was starting up. And he just looked at the whole thing. He says, this is not going the right direction.
No.
And packed up, sent my grandfather over with his sister at the age of 4 on a boat by himself, just to meet him. Just put him on the boat. And these two little kids got on the boat and the sailors took care of them to get over here. Right. And somebody over here was there to meet him and they moved to Ohio and all that. And it was, again, just like your story as well. I can empathize. It was an escape. This is wrong. We have to go.
No, I that's exactly how it happened. And that's why so many people came to the United States. And people have come here for so many reasons. But it's important to remember all the people who came even very recently because they were fleeing persecution or mass murder in some circumstances. And
whether it be South America,
yeah.
Whether it be Central America, whether it be Africa.
Exactly.
Right? It's the exact same thing, except a different theater.
And that's why I feel so personally close to people with those experiences is because people who walk up to me may not be the first thing they think about me, like, oh, you're Jewish, your grandparents must have been Holocaust survivors or something. That's fairly rare, especially nowadays. A lot of my Jewish friends don't have families with that history. They have Jewish families that have lived in the United States for much longer than that. And I have friends who are people of color, and it's just, I'm the immigrant. Their families have been here for so many generations.
400 years.
400 years, exactly. I'm the immigrant of all people. And so it's just kind of funny to just look at how we all have very different experiences and we can all just go off of each other's experiences. And that's how we build, you know, social progress, I think.
Well, I won't take up too much time, but I'm appreciative of your grandparents' experience when I grew up in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. The area I grew up in was probably well over half Jewish. And I would see, for instance, the candy store owner had the tattoos on his arm. The people on my paper route, they'd go to pay me my 60 cents a week and they'd have the tattoo on their arm. And it's, wow, this is real. This was in the 60s, so it wasn't so far removed.
Right.
But nonetheless, I'd look at that and then go look in the Encyclopedia Britannica about what it was about. And I was like, okay,
yeah.
Be nice to these people. So anyway, I totally understand. And I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah, no, that's great.
I get it. So let's do this. That's a little bit about you. Is there anything else you'd like to make sure? That what fun fact to know and tell about Ethan that is both helpful and uncommonly known?
I mean, I think it's already pretty uncommon, some of the stuff I've said. So now we can keep moving on and we'll see if I figure out anything else.
All right. Well, one of the key questions I think, and maybe the rest of Claremont thinks, I believe, is you're 22, you're a brand new grad, and there's no time better to put your education to work than the minute you graduate. Don't let it get stale. But the toughest question could be, how is it you are qualified as a 22-year-old brand new grad to be on the city council? What makes you the choice?
I'm qualified by 4 years, first of all. I think the minimum age is 18, so I'm qualified by 4 years. But no, seriously, I mean, if 22 were a disqualifier, and I don't mean by statute, but then what does qualify anyone to run for a city council of, you know, 35,000 people? What, age 30, 40, 50? In a few minutes, I'll address some other underlying issues people might have, but let's stay with my age for a few minutes. I'm 22. I graduated from Oxy last May, a great school. I learned a lot there. But over the past decade, people ages, you know, 20 to 25, very young people throughout the country have been getting elected to city councils. At age 20, Savante Myrick won his first race for alderman, which is like being on the city council of Ithaca, New York. And he was still in undergrad at Cornell. And he just won his third term last year as the city's mayor, because then he went on to become mayor. Michael Tubbs, someone who is very well known now, of Stockton, He was elected to the city council at the age I am now, 22. And 4 years later, at the age of 26, he became the youngest mayor of a city larger than 100,000 people in the entire United States. And not only have they been elected, but they've made national headlines for their passage of, you know, pilot programs for different issues, like Michael Tubbs with his universal basic income initiative. And these are just a few examples, and there are many very young people who have beaten opponents twice their age in city council elections. Moreover, it was because of their age and the passion, the perspective, and the ideas that go with their age that attracted so many people to elect and reelect these young leaders. And also someone who's a lot closer to home for all of us, Zev Yaroslavsky, who served for 40 years in LA on the LA City Council and the Board of Supervisors for the county. He's regarded as the most effective elected official in LA County history by some, and he was elected to the LA City Council, a very large city, at the age of 26, beating long-established opponents twice his age. And Zev Yaroslavsky was actually one of my first endorsements because he enjoyed seeing a young person running for a city council and wanted to endorse me. And so those are just a few examples of that. And you're right, my education is a big asset to me. I learned a lot when it comes to politics, economics, urban environmental policy. Those were the fields I studied in college.
What is your actual degree?
It's in what they call politics, which I think sounds kind of dumb. I prefer the term political science, but it's called politics. That's my BA. And then I have minors in economics and urban and environmental policy.
Okay, great. That just to frame it, right? What your educational background, what would you say the key elements of that education that are going to help you as a city council member?
Well, I think it's a very broad education I received. I wanted to take classes in many different fields of things that you would need to know if you were to get into politics. And it doesn't help, this is my perspective, it doesn't help just to know politics, but helps to know other issues that affect politics, like things relating to the economy, the local economy, like things relating to urban planning. And so these are a lot of the subject matters that I took to heart in college and really wanted to focus on and did a pretty good job at, it seems. And so I would love to take some of the things that I learned in college and apply them to Claremont, especially being a college town. There's no better place.
Can't argue that. The colleges in the town are no small component. This isn't the community college on the perimeter. This is ground zero. Yeah. And the colleges here are a big deal.
The company town.
In a way, you can say that's actually quite true. So you would resonate with which group of voters in your district best?
Well, that's tricky because obviously I think I would definitely resonate with young voters because I'm young and I can speak to their issues, but even older voters too. I don't think there's any reason why I can't resonate with them. I mean, I've always had a very close connection with the older people of my life, whether it's my grandparents or even their friends or even friends of other family members who are middle-aged to older. I find myself with other young people at family events talking with the older people more than the younger people sometimes. It's just because even from a young age, I always wanted to grow up just like any child, but I always found myself being able to really engage with older people and to discuss grown-up issues, if you will. And
Didn't you see kind of a parallel with FDR?
Yeah, I did. When I was watching, I forgot which documentary it was, something on Netflix, but the really good FDR documentary, I remember the narrator said something like, Franklin was raised by older people to be around older people. And as soon as the narrator said that, I just thought back to my childhood. I have parents who are not old by any means, but they're older than most parents of people my age. And I always remember I was so well behaved as a child because I was raised by them to be around older people and to be polite and to engage and to be able to carry my own weight, if you will.
Well, to converse and think.
Exactly.
And appreciate what older people, as older people would do.
Yeah.
So you don't see any issues in resonating both with the and being sympathetic to younger voters and their issues any more than anyone else in the district?
No, not at all. Claremont has a very well-established senior community, and they're very important to me. And I grew up around them in this city. Just growing up here, you know how important our seniors are in Claremont and Pilgrim Place is. And these are iconic senior communities that I've always enjoyed going to and can't anymore because of the whole virus. But no, I can absolutely speak to these issues, and I'm eager to speak to these issues.
And now you have some family familiarity. What is it you said your dad does?
Yeah, back in 1971, almost 50 years ago, my grandfather bought a board and care home for the mentally ill in Montclair. So right across the county line. And that's been the family business, if you will, in our section of the family for almost 50 years. One day my dad came in to help out around the office, to stay there for a couple weeks, and 35 years later, he's still there. It's always been a big part of my life growing up, the board and care home. And it's, like I said, it's for mentally ill people for the most part, mainly schizophrenia, bipolar disorder. And I grew up there, basically. I grew up going with my dad to his work, engaging with people with severe mental illness on a regular basis, playing with them, hanging out, doing whatever. They always loved seeing a young person with them, a five-year-old, a six-year-old. It made things interesting for them, having that difficult situation of having a mental illness. And
it's better than a cat or something.
It's better than a cat. I'm much better than a cat, I will have to say. But it was just such an interesting experience. It was almost one of those things you don't realize what's going on. You know, it's like, oh, so other people don't go to work with their dad at a mental home, a home for the mentally ill.
In other words, you took your hands-on exposure experience as being kind of just how things were.
Yeah.
And everybody else is, no, my dad works at a factory or an office or something.
Yeah.
No, we don't get involved.
And if it's ever an issue of who are these people, I'm like, what do you mean who are these people? These are people. They suffer from mental illness. I was thinking of people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, bad cases of people with those diseases, as being completely normal because I just grew up in that environment. I never questioned it. What's wrong with them? It gave me such a beautiful perspective on the imperfections of our society, I would say. That's why I care so much about the issue of homelessness and mental health.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that. I appreciate your perspective. It sounds like that you, from an early age, had more of a focus on understanding that different is different, but different isn't necessarily bad.
No, and it's more, we can't push people away. We have to bring them in close. That's how we help people. And that's what my family has done through our business for 49 years.
That speaks well to the experience that not everybody can bring.
Yeah.
Period. There's no going back and getting that in the meantime, right? If you started there at five, that's early.
Yeah.
That's getting on the job early.
Right? Yeah, it's even younger than 14.
Well, then there you go. I guess that's a new record. I'd like to ask, and I think you'd like to tell us, the highlights of the five, what I'll call pillars or planks of your platform. In other words, on your website, you have five key issues that you are focusing on. And I'd like to let you just speak to each of those and why you think they're important and what you can do about them.
Yeah, thanks for that. I, first of all, think we really need to protect our seniors. This is always a big priority, but now it's not even a question. So many people have died all over the country, including people in our own community of Claremont. And so protecting our seniors, making sure they're safe, but also making Claremont a safe environment for them to go and enjoy their lives is very important to me. We definitely need to do more for our seniors. And housing and policing and mental health are all intertwined in so many ways. And transportation is a very big issue here too. And then at the end, there's, of course, also the issue of what's going to happen with the Claremont Club. There's a lot of people in Claremont who are concerned about that. And so I'll talk a little bit about that as well. Where do you want to start, Russ?
As I always say, it's your show. If it were up to me, you've spoken about your familiarity with the seniors. I would say, what would be the number one thing you'd like to accomplish for the seniors in your district?
First of all, I think our leaders really dropped the ball on this virus. Leaders at all levels of government. And I'm not just talking about Trump.
Top down.
Yeah, top down. And it did get all the way to the bottom. It wasn't just Trump. If I were on the council back 6 months ago, I mean, instituting a mask ordinance would have been a no-brainer. Because as soon as Fauci said, there's asymptomatic transmission, we need masks, that should have been the end of the discussion. But instead, the state, the county, didn't do much for a couple months with a mask ordinance or mask mandate. They finally did in June. And then even after that, Claremont City Council didn't do anything either until just a few weeks ago. During this whole time, I was always asking myself, why aren't you not required to wear a mask right now in Claremont? I don't understand. But that would have been the first thing I would have done, because this isn't just an issue of protecting people. It's an issue of quality of life. I've heard so many seniors tell me, I'm afraid to leave my house because so many people just aren't wearing masks. Or someone runs by me when I'm trying to take out my trash cans and they're not wearing a mask. And so I'm just trying to avoid them outside my own house. So I definitely can't go to the village or anything, get a coffee or a pastry or anything like that. It's just frustrating that we haven't done enough as a community and our elected officials haven't done enough to make sure that we're all protecting each other. This is about protecting others. It's not about protecting ourselves. I've heard the seatbelt analogy before, and it gets you to a certain place, but it's not the same thing because we're trying to protect each other. We're trying to protect the most vulnerable among us. Like, I can't see my grandmother right now because of how out of control this has gotten. And she's, you know, in her 90s now, and I would like to see her. So we seniors is a very big issue.
Without the aid of Zoom, right?
Without the aid of Zoom, and she doesn't really use Zoom. So it's kind of just her in her house in Encino with a helper, and that's no good. But yeah, so no, these issues are really important. And so I want to talk to even more seniors to figure out what we can do to provide them a better quality of life here in Claremont.
I think mentioning the better quality of life in Claremont is the perfect segue to your next plank or pillar, if you want to call it that, housing. Affordable housing is on everyone's mind. Mm-hmm. Everybody has something to say about it, especially like when the Village South meetings come together or the Commons or you name it. Everybody wants to have affordable housing. Now, the trouble I have with most of their arguments is, what does affordable housing mean to you? If I were to go to the corner of something and something else and look one way or another, what does that look like? You tell me what, first of all, what is it you'd like to do to increase the amount of affordable housing? You know, kind of characterize what affordable housing it is that you're talking about. And if you had some examples of, oh, well, if you know the such and such development or the program or the area, that would be great.
It's one of the more complicated issues because of how impacted we are here in LA County. If you ask me, what does affordable housing mean to me? It's easy to say, don't spend more than 30% of your income on rent, because that's kind of the general rule of thumb.
But then that runs to, well, then what's your income?
Yeah, exactly. And so it all depends on income, and you can't cater every single unit in the world to someone's income. No, it is very tough. I'm very much for affordable housing. I think the Village South project is a step in the right direction, and I'd be open to looking at other parcels of land to develop into housing. I'm not a big proponent of developing deep in residential neighborhoods because I think it's just incredibly contentious and difficult and painful, and it's always just a complete hassle. And we have very nice residential neighborhoods here. I don't think we should be building massive complexes in any of them. I love the Village South project. It's transit adjacent. It's going to bring a lot to Claremont. It's going to bring revenue to Claremont, and I think that's a good thing. But listen, and you're talking about Claremont, I assume.
Of course, that's the whole...
Yeah.
This is Claremont speaks.
It's bigger than that, though, is my issue, is that we all want to live in places we can't necessarily afford. The truth of the matter is LA County is the most populous county in the entire United States, by far. It's not even close. And San Bernardino County, right next door, I could walk to it from here in a few minutes, is the largest county by area in the United States by far.
But way down on density.
Way down on density. And my thing is that land in San Bernardino County is so much cheaper. Rent is cheaper. Homes are cheaper. The building process is easier from what I've heard from people who work down there. It's less controversial when you develop more housing. I would love to work with our neighbors in San Bernardino County and the cities around us so that we can work as partners and neighbors to alleviate this crisis in LA County of housing. Because we've invested so much in our county trying to solve this problem. And we've spent, you know, over $1 billion on Measure HHH, and that hasn't gone so well.
Unless you're a consultant, right?
Unless you're a consultant, then it's gone very well for you, absolutely. But I think there's too much tunnel vision on this issue. We try and look to say, we want to build right here. We only want to do it right here because this is the community we want. So we got to make sure that we get X thousand number of new units here within 10 years. It's that we're a very large state, not just with people. There's a lot of room in this state. Like, why don't we invest in communities that have been underinvested in for generations? Places that people have left in the last, you know, several decades to go to maybe places in LA County or in the city of Los Angeles. I think there's a lot of room for the entire state to grow, and we should be working with our regional partners to do it.
You know, I attended one meeting for the Commons, and I asked the developers a number of pointy questions. One of them was, okay, look, you've got this development, which will be about 80-20 Claremont Upland, right? it's got a corner cut off that's in Upland. And I said, why don't you just make a deal and just get the boundary line changed and forget it? Yeah, you know, it's a line on the map. Just figure it out and get it done. They're like, no, I can't do that. Okay.
Yeah.
But I asked them, I said, what would be the cost and value difference for being in the exact same, we'll say, dwelling on one side or the other of that line? And he says, oh, well, we don't know. I said, come on, you're in this business. You've been in this business a long time. You know exactly what's going to happen. You're lying. And he wasn't entertained with that, to no real surprise. But I said, look, what is it going to be? If you buy in Upland or you buy the same thing across the street in Claremont, what's the difference? And he thought there was going to be about a 10% premium to own in Claremont.
At least.
And that led me to believe, well, all right, what is really so bad? Or why isn't it as desirable to be in Upland? You're literally across the street. What would you think to do to kind of even that out? In other words, make it more attractive, make it, I mean, everything's location, and yep, the location's been erased in my example. So now it's a matter of just which city and county you're in. What would be the way to even that up to make our neighbors be as just as attractive to build a house there and come to the village and do what
yeah,
they like?
Yeah.
As you said, it's only an extra 2 blocks and you're in Upland.
No, you're exactly right. What I would do is, first of all, a lot of these cities, some of them have already made good headway on providing more housing. Montclair has that entire new strip on Monta Vista Avenue of those new condos and apartments, thousands and thousands of units. And Upland's been doing the same thing with new homes. Cities are working on it and they're working hard on it. I think we should support them in their efforts. And to make it more desirable, this comes back to transportation too. We're going to have the Gold Line coming in here at some point, hopefully in 8 years or so. I would love it for the Gold Line to be further extended to out into Ontario, to the airport. If we could really connect Claremont with not just Pasadena and better with LA, like people have it in their heads right now, which is also great, and that's what I want it for, but we can also connect with our neighbors to the east. We can connect better with Montclair. We can connect with Upland. We can connect with Ontario, which is a massive city that has a lot of room to develop. And Ontario's becoming a nicer and nicer place every day. I hope that in 50 years, it's a much more even playing field all over Southern California, and that LA County isn't as impacted as it currently is, because there's only so much you can do in this place that is LA County. We have 10 million people and still growing. And like I said, there's only so much you can do.
Okay. So in other words, bring those areas up to the same level of desirability, let's say, as Claremont might be part of the plan.
Right. And if you look at the budgets of, say, Montclair, they're looking for more things. They want people to come to them. If you look at their, you know, sales tax revenue versus their property tax revenue, it's completely flipped from Claremont, because they rely so much on people coming there, making it easier for them to settle down there, and homeowners and businesses. And then they rely on the tax revenue that's generated from people just going to stores there. Because if you can attract people, you can attract customers. And so that's what they've decided to go that route instead. And Claremont's, I think, a little different, actually.
Well, Claremont is different by design.
Right, exactly.
And I was on the Future Financial Opportunities Committee in Claremont, and we looked at the sales tax revenue generated by car dealerships,
right,
big box stores, like a Best Buy or something like that, and like department stores that might be at the Montclair Mall. Mm-hmm. Although some of those, I think, are falling in popularity. I think Sears is about ready to crater, and didn't a couple of others, there's been some closings down there as well at the Montclair Mall. But it's not the rush that it used to be, but still, those contribute so much to the general fund in terms of sales tax.
Right.
Percentage that we get. Would you be open to modifying some of the rules for Claremont to maybe not change things from the way they are? I'm not saying we should put in a Best Buy, because we have those, but I've asked the mayor and the city manager and others what kind of businesses we could have come to Claremont.
Right.
For instance, maybe you heard in one of the other podcasts, do you know what the number one revenue per square foot store is in America?
Probably Apple.
No, definitely Apple. And that's taxable revenue because they sell stuff, right? It's not nails or hair, it's stuff. And maybe you can't get Apple, but would you have an idea what kind of businesses you'd like to see attracted to Claremont?
Yeah, and I've been thinking about that. It's an issue I want to look into more, especially with this COVID budget issue we have. But the number one sales tax revenue generator in Claremont is Super King. the grocery store on Auto Center Drive. And
even more than the auto dealers.
I believe so. And the auto dealers, I think, are second. I love Super King because it's very culturally diverse food. Everyone just loves having a good time there buying stuff. And it's not a big box store. It's still just a supermarket, but they've been able to market themselves in a way to attract so many different people of different nationalities, ethnicities, races to just come to this one place and just get all the stuff you need. And it's such a popular place. It's so good for our community. I would be open to looking at other, I think it's a chain or a franchise. There are other locations.
Sure it is.
But yeah, we need to look at other, you know, types of businesses like that are just incredibly popular and speak to the kind of image we want to give off in Claremont, which is that we want to be, you know, culturally sensitive. We want to be diverse and we want to maintain the sense of community.
I always think of Super King as being the polar opposite of Whole Foods.
Yeah, it is.
Just think of Whole Foods. Now, forget all that. That's what you, and then you have Super King. Except for the Amazon pickup, which I actually do like.
Yeah, that's convenient.
Of course, that won't be a big issue when Amazon builds their whole new Death Star or whatever it is down the street.
When Amazon takes over the world, yeah.
Great. Let's move on. One of the things that is on your list is policing. Now, that is probably the most sensitive of these issues. Would you agree?
I would, yes.
And everybody has an opinion. Now, what I would like to ask you up front is, do you have and can you articulate your definition, if you're even a fan of it at all, of defunding the police? What would you define that as, and is it something you're behind?
Well, you can ask 10 people and get 10 different answers. But, you know, a lot of this...
But I'm asking you.
No, I know. A lot of this defund the police stuff is, it's a reaction, a very real reaction to police misconduct, to police brutality. It's a reaction to the murders of George Floyd, the shootings of Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake, and so many other unarmed Black people who have been killed by police. And these are just the people who were killed recently. This is something that must be addressed. And while Claremont certainly is not ground zero for police misconduct by any means, I believe that no department is exempt from this movement to hold police officers accountable for their actions. But listen, and this is what I've started telling people. I'm a Democrat, okay? When I see a problem, I don't try to start defunding things, okay? That's what Republicans do when they see things they don't like, such as Planned Parenthood or the NEA or public radio, or, you know, it's a list of things. You know, when I see a problem, I look for real solutions. You can't just take someone's budget away and say, look, we've solved all the problems. And even if you did solve those problems, you're going to have four other problems that arise. That's not a real solution. I mean, our police officers aren't, you know, adequately trained to de-escalate, I don't think. They spend so much more time on the gun range learning how to kill people. And that's common all over the country. More police training should be geared toward confronting biases. We need to have regular checks with our officers to ensure that they're well psychologically. And we should have stricter screenings of applicants and raise the bar significantly on qualifications to be a police officer. We need to treat this like a very important job because it is. This gets back to the whole idea of civilianization and how we need to get rid of this kind of quasi-military mentality that we have in American law enforcement. I mean, these are public servants that we have working for us, not soldiers. Of course, we task them with taking on the most dangerous situations that, you know, exist in our society, and we should make sure that they're prepared for that. But they don't need to go into every situation with that as the first thing on their mind. We need to look at what we're teaching our officers. What are their protocols? Currently, the city of Claremont, for instance, contracts with a company called Lexipol to construct our law enforcement policies and training. Thousands of departments use them across the country. It's not controversial, but, you know, Lexipol has come under fire from civil rights experts because, you know, their number one goal is to limit a city's liability. That's really their thing. It's not really to uphold civil rights or human rights by any means. They're a business. They want to protect their clients. And so I would look into that to see if maybe there's a change that needs to be made. I don't know if there is, but that's an issue I care about.
So in other words, their direction is to protect the police from the city.
They want to protect a city from lawsuits. And so they want to make sure, as long as they're in compliance with state law, whether that state law is good or bad, they just want to make sure that cities and their clients are okay so that they'll come back to them. They're not concerned about protecting the rights of, you know, people who are stopped by police. That's just not their thing. And so we should maybe work with some very devoted nonprofits and people who are experts in civil rights to maybe tailor our policies to something that's a little more humane in many aspects. But this has become a very polarizing issue, which has made it, very difficult to get anything done. And so I want to remind everyone that change isn't won on the fringes. It's not going to happen from the, abolish the police crowd. It's not going to happen from the police unions. This is going to take a broad coalition of people to push for strong, sensible policies to greatly improve our systems of policing and accountability, which would make all of our communities safer, I would say. Back to defund the police, I think the defund the police movement is just another example of well-intentioned progressives not knowing how to brand their ideas effectively. It's really frustrating for me as someone who, I call myself a progressive. I'm someone who wants to build a coalition to pass policies to benefit our country, to benefit our city, our communities. The word defund, people say, oh, it's just reallocating. That's not what the word defund means. Oxford Dictionary says it's to remove funding completely. That's basically the definition.
And it's just a matter of how much.
Yeah, it's a matter of how much and what are you going to do with it. And I'm going to frame it right now in a different way, and maybe it'll convince people to back this movement, at least to whatever extent they feel comfortable. But let's start from the perspective that maybe we shouldn't be spending so much money on law enforcement. That's something I believe in.
Well, it's about half the general fund,
right? Yeah, it's over half the general fund. And so to start, I don't think that law enforcement officers should be responding to many of the situations that they currently respond to. These are the vast majority of situations involving traffic hazards, accidents, teenagers disturbing the peace, even things like taking reports of crimes that already happened. Why do you need an armed police officer to do that? I feel like someone else could do that. And plus, these duties take so much time out of officers' days. It's just a waste of resources. Next, there's a whole host of situations in which police officers simply don't provide the most effective response. These are the types of situations.
For example,
these are the types of situations involving homeless individuals, mental illness, what else? Domestic disputes, even just low-level drug usage. I'm not talking about people selling drugs on a street corner, but just drug usage. I think that homeless advocates, mental health professionals, counselors, social workers, they would be the most appropriate first responders for these situations. And armed police can be a secondary response in the unlikely event that it's needed, because research has shown that you almost always don't need an armed police officer to handle these situations. And just the presence of an armed officer escalates many situations, which is very bad when you're dealing with someone with a mental illness or someone in a dispute whose temper is already very high. And it's just not a cost-effective use of resources. When a police officer, for example, needs to transport someone who's having a mental health crisis to a hospital on a 5150, they have to wait with the person for the entire admissions process into that hospital. And that's 2 to 4 hours, which is time that they're spending off patrol, which is time that turns into overtime and costs the city hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
And to sit in a waiting room is not, let's say, the biggest bang for the buck.
Not a biggest bang for the buck at all. Anyone technically could wait with the person. And the bottom line is, and this is the crux of my argument, if you increase supply of more appropriate resources, demand for police officers will go down. I don't consider that defunding the police. That's just supply and demand, okay? I mean, here's an analogy, and this analogy is not factually correct, but it gets across the point. Let's say that the Department of Education was spending $10 billion a year on providing school bus service, and Congress came along and said, hey, we think that the Department of Transportation would be better at administering the service. See as how it's a school bus, it's transportation. So we're going to take that $10 billion that the Department of Education is spending on school buses, and we're going to give it to transportation to do the same thing, but do it better since they know transportation better. Would anyone honestly say, hey, you're defunding the Department of Education? No one would say that, because they're not defunding the Department of Education. It's just a better allocation of funding to get the exact same thing accomplished, but more effectively. That's what I want to do here.
So it's spending it in a better way, getting more bang for your buck, and really making the money work harder.
Making the money work harder, absolutely. We spend a lot of money on our department, on salaries, on overtime, on extra pay, on benefits. And there's a lot of people who can be trained to handle the vast majority of what are currently police calls.
At a more reasonable compensation.
Correct. And cities on their own, particularly cities the size of Claremont, can't afford to provide a lot of these new services, which is why I'm a big proponent of regional solutions and why we contract with places like Tri-City, for instance. It's also why the county of LA has things like the Homeless Outreach Mobile Engagement Program and the, you know, Psychiatric Mobile Response Teams. They're great programs as an idea, but they just can't provide the level of service that's required currently. They respond much slower than, you know, police officers, for instance, which is why people call the police. So maybe we should look into, I don't know, this is just an idea of developing a partnership with Western University to have third and fourth year medical students participate in a crisis response capacity. Whatever doctor you're becoming, you need to do internships in different areas of medicine. So psych students could get credit by providing services in the field. This is just an idea of how we can free up police services.
Well, that would be much like you visiting your dad's business, yeah. Right? In other words, you get your hands on the real article before it's your actual job.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, as an intern or something like that.
No, exactly. Medical students would be perfect for this because it's so much bang for our buck. Theoretically, we wouldn't even have to pay them. They'd be getting medical school credit to be doing this.
And college credit. Yeah. Give it to them.
And so we might as well do that.
And it would be well earned. It isn't your...
Very well earned. You know, they'd be responding to a real life crisis. Yeah.
This is reality. Here's your reality credits.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think that we could definitely look into that. But yeah, we got to be creative with these issues.
Well, very good. I think you're planting your flag on being creative.
Yeah, I'm trying to be.
Well, that's all we can ask. Now, two of the other things, and I'd like to touch on the transportation first and then the Claremont Club, because part and parcel to some of the other issues you brought up have to do with transportation. Now, not just in and around Claremont, I think the trolley experiment maybe is not going to be repeated. But right here on your website, you talk about the Gold Line and other ways of making it more walkable and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, I think it's very important with modern urban developments you have to have that walkability factor, especially a city like Claremont. That's something that we take to heart here in Claremont, that many places on the east side of LA County don't really have, which is that you can walk to our downtown from many places in Claremont. You don't really need a car if you don't want to in many times. But, you know, there's that first and last mile concept that I know the LA Metro is very concerned with, which is you need to make the first mile of someone's journey, meaning to the public transportation, very convenient and nice. And you need to make the last mile of their journey from the public transportation to their end destination also very nice and convenient.
Assuming you don't work at the bus station.
Assuming you don't work right at the station, yeah. But I think that's an idea that we really need to work on here in Claremont. And this is kind of just improving off of things that are already good, which is that we do have a walkability factor. You get off the Metrolink station and you're right in the heart of downtown Claremont, right in the village. You can walk to a whole number of places. And the same thing with the Gold Line when it gets in here in 8 years. And we need to make sure that we extend that walkability factor south of the train tracks, which is where the Village South project will be, and which is why I'm a big proponent of that project. It's not just the housing, and it's, you know, not just the affordable housing, it's the walkability factor. We're extending the reach that our downtown has to the rest of our community, north, south, east, and west. And so those are issues, urban planning issues that I care about a lot.
Let me ask a short question and give it a short answer. For the train track Indian Hill intersection, what, let's say, arrangement do you favor? Lowering the tracks, raising the road, or both?
At this point, and I kind of wish the city council realized this a little earlier, not that it's too late now or anything, but...
It's never too late.
It's not even feasible to not have a bridge. We can do it now with the Metrolink, since they come between every 20 or 90 minutes, depending on what time of day. But the Metro, and I've someone who's ridden on the Metro plenty of times, especially when I was at Occidental College, the Metro comes every few minutes, like every 5 to 7 minutes usually. So you can't have those tracks coming down every 5 to 7 minutes and also going east and west. It'll completely gum up traffic on Indian Hill. It won't just gum up traffic. Indian Hill will be paralyzed. I can assure that. It will be completely paralyzed. It won't even be a road anymore. So we need a bridge just to make it feasible.
Now, I get off the 210 at Myrtle every morning to go to work, and I think somehow they know. when I'm coming, because I, between the time I get off the freeway and get to the train tracks that are just south of the freeway, just as I'm heading, it's, oh, geez, here's a train. And I'm sure it's because they're just happen so frequently, or I always get there at 6:06 or something, but you're exactly right. You have to do something. Downtown Reno, I think, did something simply because it was a disaster right there on Virginia Street. And it had been that way ever since the town was a place to get coal and water for your steam engine.
And I, from what I know, I'm pretty sure that Metro offered Claremont like millions of dollars in grant money. I think tens of millions of dollars in grant money to help with the bridge, because we qualified for their traffic conditions to, you know, qualify for the grant. And so we were lucky enough to do that. And the council kind of kicked it down the road for over a year, when it was always an obvious solution that we need. If we're going to do this Gold Line thing, which we are certainly doing, this needs to be part of it. It's non-negotiable anymore.
And the reason I asked was because you had brought up walkability. Mm-hmm. To be able to walk across there and not get flattened by a train.
Exactly.
Is kind of core to walkability, right?
Right.
And so I just wondered which way you were leaning.
No, exactly.
Was it to make an overhead for the train or an underpass or however you wanted to go?
Yeah, it would have to be a bridge. That's really the only thing that's feasible or makes sense.
A bridge for the cars.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry.
That's why I'm asking. Which way, are you looking to... question I'm asking. Is it lower the road or raise the tracks, or what do you want to do?
No, we would have to keep the road the same, I believe. And the tracks would be elevated.
So like the stations that are along the center of the 210?
Correct. There's those ones where you go up to the platform. I know that's a thing. Yeah. We would have to either do that or somehow lower the tracks before it gets to a complete stop, which is kind of almost what Union Station does for the Gold Line. When it goes from Union Station to Little Tokyo, it goes up and then down. And so we'll have to look at that. But no, we have to keep the road the same. That would be insane to mess with the road like that. But no, we definitely need, they can't be on the same level. That's the moral of the story.
Well, I understood that. And that, my question was, which way did you want to go? But okay.
Yeah.
You're thinking of a overhead train bridge.
Correct.
What else about, you know, the Gold Line aside, because that's an issue that we could have 2 hours on on by itself. What else would you have for Claremont as your vision for increasing transportation quality in Claremont?
Well, I think buses are very important, and they're important because very low-income people tend to use buses. All the studies show that when you go from Metrolink to Gold Line or to all, you know, light rail to buses, the people who are very low income use the buses most often. And we need to make sure that we have adequate bus transportation for people who, for the very people who cannot afford any other kind of transportation. They cannot afford cars or motorcycles or scooters or anything like that. So we need to have a very solid bus, you know, experience here in East LA County. And I'll be honest, I don't ride the buses, because it's complicated and it's difficult.
And I was going to tell you that the buses up and down Mills where I live, they don't stop. This is absolutely true. I'll make it short. For about 2 weeks, my car was indisposed. And I thought, well, I'll just take the bus to San Dimas and back for work. And I stood out at the bus stop sign on Mills Avenue. And the driver drove by, didn't even blink. And then it's okay. I got to wait a half hour for the next one. So I went back to my house right there and got a flashlight, and I waved the next one down like I was trying to land an airplane. And the guy still drove by, hit the brakes, backed up, and he says, "What do you want?" And I was like, "A ride? I'm here at the bus stop." And he says, "Nobody ever gets on here. Yeah. Never." And he said, "I've been on this route for years. Nobody's ever been picked up here."
Right.
And it's not only complicated, it's also unusual. There are areas where I don't think bus service is well employed.
No, I'd completely agree with that. We need a holistic view, or not view, vision of transportation. And it goes everywhere from cars to trains to light rails to buses. And buses oftentimes are kind of left out of the equation of the discussion, but that's definitely something we need to include from now on.
And besides that, I'm a big fan of electric buses.
Yes.
Because the buses we have look like an environmental disaster. Seriously, because they're driving this monster bus with a huge diesel engine, and there is no buddy on the bus other than the drivers. Really?
Yeah.
You could drive a Prius and have the same amount of ridership.
Yeah. No, that you're right about that.
And then finally, because it's a hot button right now, and there's been about a wide range of speculation as to what's going to happen, what is the plan and what would be your solution for the Claremont Club?
Yes. Well, I was a lifelong resident of Claremont. I grew up at the club. My parents have been members for a very long time. When it closed, it was...
It's an institution.
It's an institution. You can get mad that it's a private institution. It's an institution very, you know, near and dear to people in the community. When it closed last month, it was like a gut punch. My parents have been members there since they first moved to Claremont in 1990, and they were living in the condos next door. My parents and I worked out at the club. When I was a kid, I'd go to the summer camps every year. When I was a baby, I was one of the first to participate in the club's new childcare program. I've heard so many people talking about what the club provided for them, and it was really a community, especially for all the seniors that would work out early in the mornings, who worked out together for decades. You'd make friends with people who you probably wouldn't have met outside the club, and then maybe you'd run into them in the village and strike up a conversation. It was a good way for people to relax and connect. It was even home to the Perfect Step Paralysis Recovery Center, which was, you know, such a fantastic program, doing unbelievable work for those in our community with paralysis. And a club was just, yeah.
So you would say Claremont needs this facility?
Yes.
One way or another, regardless of who owns it, it in some way, shape, or form needs to retain this as a club.
It does, for the most part. I from what I heard from someone, I think bids maybe closed on Friday for buyers, and there were several people who were companies that wanted to buy it, which is good. I'm pushing for someone to buy the club and continue to run it. If that doesn't happen, and then I'm open to other solutions. I know you've proposed solutions, but I do think we need to keep this as a club, like I said. Calabasas, the city of Calabasas, went through the same thing 25 years ago. They had an athletic club that closed, and it was a terrible loss to the community, and so the city worked to raise funds to purchase it. And they were able to get a lot of county recreation funds and a few private investors, and they purchased their club. And after they did that, they were like, we don't know if this is going to work. Well, they had, virtually speaking, lines out the door of people wanting to get memberships, who wanted to go to the club. They made it open to the public for a fee. And these are very important institutions for communities, so much so that even the California Supreme Court, in a case called, I think it was Ehrlich v. City of Culver City, even affirmed that private recreational facilities have real value in cities and communities. And they even upheld a city's ability to fine an owner of someone who was closing one of these private institutions in order to repay the community for the burden of closing it down. This is serious stuff. Like,
that probably caught the owner way unaware.
Oh yeah, it did. It worked all its way. It worked its way up.
Being sued to stay open.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so it was like, no, you either got to stay open or pay this fee because our community needs this and wants this. And no, this is very important stuff. I'm open to so many different solutions. I even heard someone, it was more a joke, but you know, someone who's familiar with the Historical Landmark Commission for LA County, and they're like, well, the club's been around for 47 years, and 50 years is kind of the benchmark for a landmark in LA County, so why don't you try and get it landmark status? And I was like, that's pretty funny, but like, I'm open to everything.
See, that's totally out of the box, and I love it.
Yeah, no, it's great.
No, seriously, I mean, someone was at work? Okay. My thought was to, when they were battling about the police station, right? One of the expenses for the police station was that they were showing that where they were going to put a gym in the police station. And I thought, well, okay, why don't we make use of the Claremont Club and then put the police station in the gym?
Exactly.
And bang, it's right up the street from the place that the police station was going to be anyway at one point. And it's a done facility. They got all their exercise equipment. They got nice bathrooms. They got everything ready to go there, right? Done. Sell the other one, fix it up, have a nice day. That's not going to happen, but it's an idea.
Yeah, no, and I'm open to all ideas, like I said. Is there time to touch on homelessness briefly?
This is your show, and we can take the time you would like.
Yeah, I guess it's the listeners that have to listen through it. So
no, that's not true. The trick about podcasting is they can stop, restart it later, or fast forward.
I know, you're right.
Take the time you need just to be, you know, keep it interesting, of course.
Yeah.
But take the time you need to make sure your point is fully made.
Let's get into homelessness. All right. My thing with homelessness is I want to prioritize homeless individuals who are mentally ill. And of course, this has to do with my family's background. LA County is unique in that it is both the homeless capital of the nation and the mental health crisis capital of the nation. So we get both of those awards. If you total the number...
That's like almost a grand slam.
Almost a grand slam. We're going for the cycle, I believe. If you total the number of mentally ill people in LA County and LA County adjacent San Bernardino County cities, Montclair, Upland, Chino, who are homeless or on the verge of becoming homeless, you have a population roughly the size of Claremont. It's that many people. They could be their own city. They're also homeless, mentally ill people are the ones who have the worst outcomes on the streets. They're the ones who are killed by police most often. They're the ones who wind up in jails, prisons, and county hospitals, which cost so much more money than it would cost to house them in residential low-level care homes. We need a better solution than just subsidizing homeless shelters and dispatching city resources to give unsheltered people supplies like food and water. That's not enough.
Or jail time just over something.
Or jail time. It costs so much money. It costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to bring people to and from jail. Just that alone. Why would we... It doesn't make any economic sense, but nonetheless.
And if I'm any student of the police blotter in the Courier, most people get a citation and get released.
Right.
And I'm just like, well, wait a minute. How do you differentiate between, yeah, you did a bad thing. Okay, off you go. Or no, we need to keep you here. This whole crack pipe, stolen car thing is more than just like, here, don't do it again and hope you show up.
Yeah. And as I said before, a lot of this stuff, the stolen car thing is different, but you know, the crack pipe thing should definitely be handled through more of a medical route than a law enforcement route. But my bottom line is we need to increase our ability to house homeless people with mental illness. They're state licensed, SSI rate, board and care, adult residential facilities across LA County and other places in the state that house the mentally ill for a fraction of what assisted living facilities charge. These are the types of places that my family has run for 50 years. The SSI reimbursement rate, the amount that these places charge, is only $1,069 per month, compared to the $3,000, $8,000 sometimes that an assisted living facility would charge. Homeless people who are mentally ill are generally qualified for SSI, given their extremely low level of resources and their mental illness. So they could receive SSI payments.
Yeah, it's not all Howard Hughes running off the rails, right?
Correct. It's not. They can get these payments to afford a board and care home, which provides not just shelter, say just putting up a building and saying, here, go live here, but it provides shelter, meals, medication management, and transportation to and from medical appointments. And they would get Medicaid on top of that because SSI recipients automatically receive Medicaid or Medi-Cal in California. So our thinking on this issue has been completely short-sighted. Homeless shelter operators receive twice the amount of money that board and care home operators receive. And homeless shelters are a 2 to 3 day solution, whereas a stay at a board and care home can average about 5 years. The county of Los Angeles deems a 3 month stay as a successful placement for an unsheltered person. That's how low our expectations are out here and how little is asked of our counties who get state contracts. The state says to fulfill this contract, we'll give you the money and you need to keep these people out of our county hospital because it costs so much money and you need to keep them in a placement for 3 months. And that's considered a success, 3 months. Our thinking's been so economical. An unsheltered person who winds up in a hospital, it costs the county $1,000 per day. In a stable, supportive environment like a board and care home, it costs the state only $1,000 per month. A motel voucher, much like a homeless shelter, is a 2 to 3 day solution. It doesn't come with all the supportive services that board and care homes provide. What's happened, and this is very sad, and we're moving in the wrong direction, is that a lot of these SSI rate board and care homes are closing in LA County and elsewhere because the state has decided just not to invest in them. Board and care home operators, you know, have to pay their employees salaries, food, supplies, utilities, just like any other business owner. But over the last 5 years, the SSI reimbursement rate, and this is key, the SSI reimbursement rate, what these, you know, facilities get from the state has increased by about 5% in the last 5 years. Minimum wage has increased 35%. Board and care homes can't even afford to pay their employees anymore. It's that simple. Well, I want minimum wage to increase. Don't get me wrong. I'm a big supporter of increasing the minimum wage. But, you know, board and care homes can't pass the cost off to the consumer like Burger King could. The state mandates what they can charge. And currently, especially in LA County with expensive land, with high land values, it's much more profitable for an owner of one of these valuable institutions to just sell their land to the highest bidder. And they'll just build market rate condos on them. We need to invest in these SSI facilities by raising the rate for SSI reimbursement. Even if we were to do that, it'd still be so much cheaper than anything else we have. We need to get homeless mentally ill individuals into the federal assistance system and use those funds to provide them with long-term housing. People might get queasy about the whole, oh, do we want, you know, just put everyone on these federal assistance programs? Well, the only other alternative is to have them spend $1,000 a day at a hospital or have the police constantly responding to them. So that costs a lot more money in the long run.
Which is no bargain.
It's no bar. It's not even close. Putting everyone on SSI would be a big number on paper in the beginning for sure. But it would be so much cheaper in the long run, astronomically cheaper.
Well, okay. And then how would you propose
getting them on that?
Getting that done here.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it requires a much more hands-on approach, because in order for you to go this route with, say, someone who's homeless and mentally ill on the streets, they need to agree to accept these services. And that's a sticking point oftentimes. People with mental illness, it's part of their mental illness that they can be very difficult to deal with. And they oftentimes don't even acknowledge the existence of their illness. And so in order to get them on these very helpful systems that'll save us a lot of money in the long run, we either have to engage more with them and convince them that we are really there to help them. We're not there to send them to jail or get them in trouble. We're trying to help them have a better life, a more stable life.
To
get the help they really need, and we'll help them do it, and we'll do it for them. Or if that doesn't work, which doesn't always work, there's also the option of, you know, conservatorship, which is where someone's diagnosed with an illness and a judge says, well, you can't take care of yourself. You need someone to handle all of your business, your finances, make decisions for your life. And the pendulum has kind of swung in both directions in the last 30 years of whether we should be putting people on conservatorship, whether we shouldn't be. We need to be very mature and take this very seriously, because you're essentially taking away someone's rights when you put them on conservatorship.
But isn't that more of a case-by-case basis? In other words, if making a conservator out of a family member might be someone who actually cares about the person.
No, exactly.
Making a conservator out of someone who's an institutional conservatorship business, they're just looking for, hey, what's the check, right?
Yeah.
And those are kind of the polar opposites.
Yeah, and that's why we have to watch out for that, because there have been instances of conservatorship abuse, and those are the most horrifying cases you can read about. But that's not what happens the vast majority of the time. The vast majority of the time is someone gets on conservatorship and they're put in a board and care home or a similar type of home. And it's a very stable living environment. It's a community. My dad's place is one of the larger places in the area, and it has about 75 beds. This is a real community of people, and they're treading water like every other board and care home. But yeah, we need to reverse this cycle, because this is homelessness. If more of these places close, these people are not going to another board and care home. They're going on the streets. They're not going with a family member. A lot of them don't have family members. They're going on the streets. So if these places keep closing, we are going to see tens of thousands of more homeless people in LA County. I can promise you that.
And Claremont will get its share.
Oh, we will definitely get our share. Absolutely.
It's like Santa Barbara to me. It's like, how come there's so many homeless folks in Santa Barbara? It's, well, if you're going to be homeless, Santa Barbara's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I mean, a Koreatown is not quite as nice as Santa Barbara. Let's go hang there. I get it. And they also get overfilled. I've been to, as I said, Koreatown a number of times, and the tents are just everywhere.
Oh yeah. They're just tent cities at this point. They're Hoovervilles. That's what LA County has become, is a Hooverville, one large Hooverville. And I don't understand why we have to repeat instances of the Great Depression on a daily basis in this country, even before the pandemic.
Well, I would think the government's first order of business is to never have the Great Depression.
Yeah.
Again, you need to fix this. We tried that, didn't work. Okay, let's do anything else. Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So, Ethan, you've pretty much covered your main pillars and homelessness as well. What would you like to, offer Claremont as a summary of your personal perspectives and why you think you're the best candidate?
Well, I bring a unique perspective to this election, and hopefully to the council as well. I can speak to the issues of everyone in Claremont, like we talked about before. I'm uniquely qualified to speak to the issues of younger generations and the ones who have, you know, had to deal with the Great Recession and then the COVID-19 pandemic right out of the gate. Right as they became adults, right as we became adults, graduated from college and started working, we've been hit with just, you know, trouble after trouble. And
you didn't even get out of college clean. Your graduation was by Zoom or something.
No, I caught a piece of it. My final semester was the COVID semester of 2020. And yeah, that's, I know what it feels like to have to learn via Zoom, because I was learning via Zoom. Now everyone is, and I feel very sorry for them because it wasn't the greatest experience. The issues of student debt and the inability to afford to live in most places in Southern California, other than their parents' house, I can relate to that. And especially in a college town, I think that's very important. To wrap up, I'll say we're entering a new era in American politics, in American society. I think we can all feel it. The issues of the day are the issues that my generation has championed. Police brutality, criminal justice reform, climate change, income inequality, the movement to promote Black lives, public transportation. These are issues that young people across the nation, they've decided to roll up their sleeves and shape the country they want to live in. And one of the videos of Chadwick Boseman that was just released, he said something that I've actually been saying for a few years now, which is that something along the lines of, my generation, we're no longer the voices of tomorrow, we're the voices of today. And there are many ways that people can get involved, and people find ways to get involved, which is great. Continuing my involvement in politics, and now as a candidate for office, is how I've decided to contribute, to pursue a more perfect city, a more perfect community. And if more of us did that across the country, maybe we could actually get closer to having a more perfect union.
Very eloquent. Nicely said. Let me ask then three more questions. Well, no, very, very short ones. First of all, I like to wrap up the podcast with a call to action. Having listened to this whole podcast, or at least their favorite parts, right? What would you like the listener to do as a result, besides vote for you?
Yeah.
We get that.
I would say that politics is fought on many fronts. It's not all about what's happening in the White House. It's about what's happening in your state legislatures. It's what's happening in your counties and in your cities and in your neighborhoods. And it's very easy with all the cable news to get wrapped up in all the national politics, but it's just as important, if not more important, to focus on what's happening in our local communities and to see who are the players, who are the new players in our local elections. Is there something new that they bring? And should I be reaching out to see what are the right things for my city? I think everyone just, my rallying cry is get involved with your local elections.
Very good. Very good. And then the number one takeaway?
Yeah. If what I want people to take away from this whole interview is just how everyone comes from very unique backgrounds, and it's very hard to just assume what someone is or has been. I'm very proud of my involvement, and not just that, even more so my upbringing, because my parents didn't make me cower in the corner for all the bad or unpleasant things in the world. They wanted me to experience it and go out and learn about it. And so I feel so satisfied with the way that my parents wanted me to know so much about all the things in our world that people my age don't have much experience with. Going back to all the mental health stuff, it's really just a once in a lifetime opportunity to be able to have those kinds of experiences and that kind of knowledge at such a young age. And that's why I wanted to run. And that's what I want people to take away from this, that I'm with you. There's hardly anything that I haven't heard before or seen before. So yeah, that's what I want people to take away.
Okay. Now, final thing, it's time for the segment of the program I like to call Shameless Self-Promotion. Where can people learn more about you, learn more about your campaign, contact you, contribute, help? Tell us anything you want that would help you. This is your show. Give us your best.
Yeah. So have a website. That's probably the best place to go. EthanResnick.com. That's pretty simple. Well, it's actually not simple because people misspell my name a lot. So it's with a Z and a K. So Ethan Resnick, R-E-Z-N-I-K. And yeah, EthanResnick.com. You'll find policies there. We're continuing to update it every day. I have social media too, but yeah, I don't, that's not as important. I prefer people go to the website. And so yeah, please go.
So
there.
No Instagram.
We have Instagram. I think it's Ethan for City Council. And yeah, and if you need to know how to spell my name, you'll maybe see some signs around town.
I think these signs are multiplying like rabbits.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have to apologize to everyone. I caved
on it.
No,
everybody's
doing it. I caved on it.
Claremont loves signs. at the last council meeting, I proposed that the candidates have promotional masks and that Claremont could sell masks that were Claremont promoting and Claremont branded and approved.
I was thinking of that.
Why not? And it's like I said, it's the yard sign that walks around and talks.
Yeah, exactly.
But Mr. Schroeder was not entertained. Well, then if there's nothing else, I would like to say thank you for, first of all, having this podcast be your first.
Yes.
For listening. But for most of all, coming on and showing Claremont in no uncertain terms that you are an eloquent, intelligent, and very capable candidate for the City Council District 1. I think there's no reason that they should discount you on age or anything else, and that they should take a closer look before they just out of hand make a decision. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say. And even if people need a national example, just look at the 1992 presidential election. We had the first president running born after World War II versus the older president, George H.W. Bush. And who did the American people pick? It was the guy with vision, the new guy who people didn't know a year earlier. And that's a trend even today. And I say that we should go that route, especially right now.
Try something new rather than the status quo. Right? Okay. Well, again, Ethan, thank you very much. I appreciate your time on this, and I think the listeners will too. And Claremont, I'd like to invite you to tell a friend to listen and be here next time when Claremont speaks. Thank you.